This month on Focus, Black Oklahoma. We break down misconceptions of critical race theory with professors from Oklahoma's two largest state universities. We'll also look at how a Bartlesville librarian spent decades bringing the community together and how the institution she worked for did not. We'll also hear about the upcoming Martin Luther King celebrations and hope for the Tulsa community in the new year. How healthy is Oklahoma? We'll let you know with our new mindfulness and media series. We're also decolonizing menus, foraging, and maybe letting you know where to find your next favorite meal. And the advice we give to our loved ones and how they often ignore it. All of this and more on Focus, Black Oklahoma.
Focus Black Oklahoma is sponsored by Phillips Theological Seminary, with guest lectures, sermons, and presentations for Black History and African American Heritage Month. Online at ptstulsa.edu/heritage.
This is Focus Black Oklahoma. I'm Kuma Roberts.
And I'm Colby Webster.
Focus Black Oklahoma has been selected to participate in the Advancing Democracy Cohort with the Solutions Journalism Network, or SJN. Our series, In a Confused State, will follow Oklahoma advocacy groups navigating new restrictions on freedoms in four areas: reproductive rights, voting laws, teaching history, direct action, and activism. Here, Judy Williams breaks down the misconceptions of critical race theory, or CRT, and the fact that it's not a new concept and that it is often misunderstood.
Over the past year and a half, discussions and debates have played out across the United States, everywhere from classrooms to school board meetings to legislative bodies and the media. These disputes focus on the teaching of racism. And many conservative legislatures, including Oklahoma's, have now banned instruction on this issue. Teaching about racism is often conflated with critical race theory, or CRT, another subject of debate. In a May 2021 article for Education Week, Stephen Salchuk explained that while experts disagree on the exact definition of CRT and its role in our academic discourse, the concept is not new. In fact, it dates back over 40 years, emerging in the late 70s and early 80s from the work of legal scholars like Derrick Bell, Kimberly Crenshaw, and Richard Delgado. And its core ideas are that race is a social construct, and that racism is not merely the byproduct of individual bias and prejudice, but embedded in legal systems and policies. In other words, racism is institutional. Many scholars see this framework as one of CRT's strengths. Rilla Askew, a writer and University of Oklahoma professor, is one of them.
It's an important way for us to understand the truth of how racism has affected everything in terms of American history that has brought us to this moment.
For Professor Askew, this moment dates back to the summer of 2020, when protests erupted in cities across the country following George Floyd's murder. It's a moment that in many ways echoed earlier eras.
You know, when you look back at history, these epical changes have happened again and again. It's all of the changes that have been going on and continuing, since the beginnings of the civil rights movement.
Dr. Kalinda Eaton, who also teaches at the University of Oklahoma, shares this broad view of history. She believes that a long sequence of events led to CRT becoming a cultural touchstone, and that race was central to the story.
In my opinion, I think this latest iteration actually has been at least a decade in the making. So that would put us squarely with the election of President Obama. The thinking about how that election prompted this most recent backlash. So, I mean, even though he was a fairly moderate president by most standards, most of the nation reacted to his very being with distaste and frustration and disrespect and concern and hatred. And the fact that some of our more liberal facets of the nation completely dismissed or ignored these other reactions, I think definitely started fueling this flame.
Recall, for example, that President Donald Trump built support through his insistent and false claims that President Obama was not a U.S. citizen. Nehemiah Frank, the editor of Tulsa's Black Wall Street Times, sees the Trump years as
a time period of dog whistle politics on steroids. We have a president who won on the promise of making America great again or making America white again. And I hate to say that, but I definitely don't say it lightly. You know, since the beginning of his campaign, he was very anti-foreigners. And that rhetoric, there were people in his base that were attracted to it.
That base was especially strong in Oklahoma, where all 77 counties voted for Trump in the 2016 presidential race. 2 years later, all but four counties backed Governor Kevin Stitt, a candidate who, with his business background and lack of political experience, resembled the 45th president. And there were other similarities. In September 2020, for example, Trump took to his now-defunct Twitter page to rail against racial sensitivity training, white privilege training, and CRT. And on September 4th that year, the Office of Management and Budget, or OMB, released on Trump's instruction a memo instructing federal agencies to identify and terminate any CRT training programs in effect for government employees. Stitt followed suit the following spring. On May 7th, 2021, he signed into law Oklahoma House Bill 1775. Representative Kevin West wrote the bill, and it was subsequently co-sponsored by over 30 Republican state senators. The 5.5-page document states that it shall be the policy of the Oklahoma State Board of Education to prohibit discrimination on the basis of race or sex in the form of bias, stereotyping, scapegoating, classification, or the categorical assignment of traits, morals, values, or characteristics based solely on race or sex. Public schools in this state shall be prohibited from engaging in race or sex-based discriminatory acts by utilizing these methods, which result in treating individuals differently on the basis of race or sex, or the creation of a hostile environment. Other passages in the bill read like close copies of the statements Trump delivered months before. For example, the OMB memo announced its aim to stop any teaching that suggests the, quote, United States is an inherently racist or evil country, or that any race or ethnicity is inherently racist or evil, end quote. In Representative West's version, the prohibition targeted any teacher, administrator, or other school employee who taught that an individual, by virtue of his or her race or sex, is inherently racist, sexist, or oppressive. We asked Representative West about cases of CRT instruction, whether in his home city of Moore or elsewhere, that motivated him to push for this piece of legislation.
To the best of my knowledge, it's not happening here in Moore. I've not been notified of that.
Stacy Takas, a professor at Oklahoma State University, believes that this lack of clarity, the blurry nature of the threat the bill is meant to combat, is reflected in the legislation's language itself. To her, it's rife with misunderstanding.
If you read the bill, you'll notice that nowhere do they mention critical race theory in the actual bill itself. But they reference concepts that are often confused with critical race theory by people who've never actually read any critical race theory. This is really a kind of gift to the political base more than it is a set of educational policies.
And those are just some of the criticisms leveled at the law since its passage. The American Civil Liberties Union, for example, joined with the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law and other groups last October to sue the state of Oklahoma. In their view, House Bill 1775 violated, quote, the constitutional rights of teachers across Oklahoma by restricting conversations around race and gender at all levels of education, end quote. And they asked the federal judge to immediately halt its enforcement and to then declare it unconstitutional under the First Amendment, which protects free speech, and the 14th Amendment, which guards against discrimination. Representative West feels these charges miss the point.
It's actually an anti-discrimination bill, the way that it's written. It goes in both directions. It would protect what the mindset was, say, back in the 1920s, just like it protects what the mindset is today.
Whatever motivated this reference to the 1920s, for many Oklahomans, and especially for many Tulsans, the date calls to mind an especially dark moment. The Tulsa Race Massacre, which marked its centennial last spring, happened in 1921. And writers like Rilla Askew fear that HB 1775 will shut down conversations about that event, conversations that took far too long to begin.
There's language in the bill that says that none of this is supposed to affect the Oklahoma academic standards. But the Oklahoma academic standards do require us to teach about the Tulsa Race Massacre, for instance. I mean, there was an active effort to suppress that history. These bills are designed to, in effect, do that same thing, but with the lie in the mouth of saying, well, but it's not going to affect our Oklahoma academic standards. And now it has become law that we must teach this. But where does that put that history teacher, that, you know, 11th grade history teacher whose academic standards say this is what we have to teach, whose administration says, well, don't do anything that's going to upset anybody.
The classroom is just one site that could feel the effects of HB 1775. In addition to Askew's hypothetical example, there's the case of Oklahoma City's Melissa Smith. Just weeks after the new law passed, Oklahoma City Community College canceled one of her classes, which focused on race and ethnicities. But the full scope of the law's impact is much broader. Dr. Eaton spoke about its campus-wide repercussions.
One clear example is that the University of Oklahoma was really excited about the ways in which we could bring students who are first-year students and transfer students into the community. That was through a course that focused on diversity. But then after the bill was passed, there had to be a lot of changes, right, to the mandatory, quote-unquote, nature of that course. It's very different when you're saying that, you have this option, then, this is something that we are committed to as a university, and we want you to understand that, this is the space that you're walking into.
Dr. Erica Townsend Bell, a professor at Oklahoma State University, describes other ways this new legislation could undermine college-level education.
It seems quite clear to me that if anybody is going to be accused of somehow running afoul of CRT, it is likely to be scholars of color. And in many cases, that's going to end up being a scholar who was pre-tenure and feeling more especially vulnerable.
Dr. Townsend Bell's observation describes well the case of Nicole Hannah Jones, who was denied tenure by the University of North Carolina last year. Hannah Jones is the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter behind the New York Times 1619 Project, which traces American slavery back 400 years to the start of the colonial endeavor that would eventually become the United States. The 1619 Project, through its examination of the ways slavery shaped this country's history, has been a lightning rod for critical race theory's opponents. Hannah Jones's case reflects broader trends in higher education. When the American Association of University Professors analyzed federal data last year, it found that in 2018, while Black people make up 13.4% of the U.S. population, they account for less than 6% of the faculty at public and private nonprofit four-year colleges in the U.S., and just 2% of tenured professors are Black women. But gloomy as the current landscape may seem, it's not entirely bleak. Nehemiah Frank, whose Black Wall Street Times regularly addresses racial discrimination, sees this moment as an opportunity for activism.
I would say that parents who want their kids to learn the truth, they need to speak up. They have to be vocal. And when I tell you, like, they have to physically do it. They have to put campaigns together to say that, you know, House Bill 1775 is hurting my kid.
Then there's the point Professor Takis made earlier about the vagueness in the bill's language. That vagueness not only renders the legislation confusing, in her view, it also creates an opportunity for teachers. She actually taught the bill and the debate surrounding it in one of her upper-level undergraduate classes, a class of mostly white students.
I had them read the text of the bill. It was a really interesting, I expected a little pushback from a couple of students, but in fact, everyone who read the bill said, this is a really poorly crafted bill. I mean, it was really interesting, fun. I mean, as fun as something like that can be, but it generated great discussion.
And Professor Takis' story is just one encouraging report to emerge from Oklahoma schools this academic year. On the day after Christmas, The Oklahoman reported that Oklahoma City's Millwood Public Schools, a majority black district, quote, doesn't shy away from discussions of race and inequality, end quote, even in the aftermath of HB 1775. Millwood Arts Academy history teacher Sheva Smith, for example, still reviews the 1921 race massacre with his students. Cecilia Robinson Woods, the district superintendent, has stated that discussions of race and inequality are still very much on the table. And Anthony Crawford, an English teacher at Millwood High School, said the law, quote, didn't really affect things in his classroom, end quote. But Crawford is also part of a group of plaintiffs suing to overturn HB 1775. His case reminds us that even as we seek to preserve spaces for difficult conversations, we must remain vigilant. For Focus Black Oklahoma, I'm Judy Williams in Oklahoma City.
Despite a 30-year history of activism and fighting for anti-segregation, a Bartlesville librarian is remembered with words for her service to the community. But the actions she longed for have fallen on deaf ears. Devin Williams has details.
Ruth Brown was a civil rights activist and librarian at the Bartlesville Public Library, or BPL. She juggled life as a librarian and activist for 30 years. On BPL's Eastern Outer Wall, a mural honoring Brown, sponsored by Phillips 66, reads, "With thankfulness and appreciation for Miss Ruth Brown, Bartlesville librarian from November 1919 to July 1950. Miss Brown loved to read to children. Bartlesville Public Library celebrates Miss Ruth Brown and her service to our community." Brown is one of the most important anti-segregationists in Oklahoma history. Brown's activism was a large part of her personal and professional life. In 1946, she and a small group of desegregationists founded the Committee on the Practice of Democracy, or COPD, an affiliate of the Congress of Racial Equality, or CORE. It was the first of its kind south of the Mason-Dixon line. According to the BPL's own website, Miss Ruth Brown is nationally recognized as the first librarian in the United States to receive help from the Intellectual Freedom Committee of the American Library Association. She could also be seen around town with her friends, Jean Jones, Mary Ellen Street, and Clara Cook, attending church services in all-white segregated churches. All of these friends were black women, a fairly unremarkable sight today, but social suicide in Jim Crow-era Bartlesville. After her numerous attempts to desegregate the BPL and Bartlesville as a whole, Miss Brown was terminated for being a suspected communist. According to the book, The Dismissal of Ruth Brown, by Louise S. Robbins, Ruth Brown was dismissed because of her commitment to desegregation and racial equality. Bartlesville eventually desegregated in 1956, 2 years after the landmark Supreme Court ruling of Brown versus Board of Education. Sonia Settle, the former librarian of youth services at BPL, says there is a cultural and educational segregation in Bartlesville. Ms. Settle explains how Brown's story inspired her to write a children's book.
So when I graduated from library school in 2017, my first job was at Jane Phillips Elementary School. And I did some lessons on Martin Luther King Jr. And I would ask the students, give them dry erase boards and ask them to write down everything that they knew about Martin Luther King Jr. And they knew nothing. They would write, well, they might know the I Have a Dream speech. That would be something that they would get correct. Many of them would say he freed the slaves, things like that. And so it became very clear to me that black and white children at Jane Phillips didn't understand anything about what Martin Luther King had done and why it was important or significant, why it was necessary. This was concerning to me just because we here in Bartlesville have our own significant piece of history with the equal rights movement through Ruth Brown. And so I had decided to write about Ruth Brown because I felt like it was a story that specifically the children of Bartlesville need to know about. And so I had decided to write a children's book about her.
There is no mention of Miss Brown's activism and sacrifice on the mural. Settle says that to this day, BPL remains deliberately silent on issues of race. This assumed neutrality is in stark contrast of Brown herself, whom the BPL seem eager to honor throughout the library. Brown said, people can no longer be neutral on the question of race. Settle details her disapproval of BPL's lack of solidarity during the George Floyd protest.
On June 2nd, I asked the director of the Bartlesville Public Library, who was my boss at the time, if I could repost the American Library Association post or the Oklahoma Department of Libraries post about the 31 children's books against racism. So on June 2nd, I was told, and the staff was told, to remain Switzerland. So that was quite a shock that I was not allowed to repost and share the anti-racist post from our state professional organization, our national professional organization.
Undeterred by current BPL director Shelley McGill's first rejection to publicly denounce racially motivated violence, Settle attempted again to spotlight anti-racist literature at BPL.
Essentially, I was not able to do my job. That's what librarians do. That's the values of the library profession, is to inform.
In July 2019, a local women's rights group called the Bartlesville Women's Network proposed adding Ruth Brown Memorial to the name of Bartlesville Public Library. In meeting notes taken during a board meeting, Brittany Hess, a board member, said, quote, it almost seems like a slap in the face to request a name change at this time. Despite Settle's efforts, BPL has remained deliberately silent regarding public statements of support for the modern-day civil rights movement. BPL declined our request for an interview for this story. For Focus Black Oklahoma, I'm Devin Williams in Bartlesville.
You're listening to Focus Black Oklahoma. Tulsa's Martin Luther King Commemoration Society is preparing for its annual festivities and urges participants to seek hope, action, and the fierce urgency of now, which is the theme for this year's celebration. Carlos Moreno has the story.
Hope, excitement, and an urgent commitment to social justice fill the auditorium of OSU Tulsa as the Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Commemoration Society makes its final preparations for the 43rd annual Martin Luther King Jr. Parade. The parade will begin on Monday, January 17th at 11 a.m. at the corner of North Detroit Avenue and John Hope Franklin Boulevard, just north of the OSU Tulsa campus, near the Standpipe Hill Historical Marker. Les Thompson, the Commemoration Society's president, spoke to the hope the parade provides the community.
You know, we're going through the virus epidemic, And we want to have the parade. We want to keep it going because it gives people hope. It gives us the hope that, you know, things are going to be all right. Things are going to be okay. Everything's going on in the world today. People need hope, especially here in Tulsa, Oklahoma, where we have closing of the schools and some of the religious organizations are not meeting. But we want people to know that Martin Luther King organization is alive and well.
Organizers, sponsors, parade volunteers and participants are excited for the return of dance groups and marching bands. Booker T. Washington High School, KIPP Tulsa University Prep, and McLean High School marching bands will be featured in the parade, one of the oldest and longest-running Martin Luther King Jr. parades in the nation.
Up to 2021, we were the third largest parade in the country behind Houston and Dallas, and I think that's quite an accomplishment for Tulsa, Oklahoma.
The theme for the Commemoration Society this year is Hope and Action, the Fierce Urgency of Now. The nonprofit selects the theme carefully and weaves it throughout its various programs during the year. Commemoration Society board member Jamie Broom shares how the Society arrived at this year's theme.
Reading through some of Dr. King's speeches and the things that he was, you know, very passionate about, you know, came the theme. You know, we have hope. We need action, and we need it now.
While the Commemoration Society is most well known for the annual Martin Luther King Jr. Parade, the organization does much more for the community, in large part collaborating with local schools to host dance and music competitions, writing and oratory contests, all to provide students with scholarship opportunities.
We have scholarship opportunities for high school, you know, graduating seniors. And it's not just seniors who have academic success, right? It's seniors who've displayed community service. We also have scholarships that are awarded to those who not necessarily go on to college, but to tech school, right? In addition to that, during the cycle of the parade, we have contests that are geared towards elementary students. We have those art contests, we have essay contests for middle school, and then we have the I Have a Dream speech oratorical contest for our high school students. We have liturgical, the dance contest that the students can actually win cash prizes. I mean, like our oratorical winner will win $1,000. So everything that our sponsors donate in terms of the parade and just our board, the organization, we give back to those communities.
Commemoration Society volunteer Carmen Petty, who served on the board for 21 years, is also inspired by the words of Dr. King. For Ms. Petty, Dr. King, speaking about the urgency to address injustices now, brings to mind current attempts by the Oklahoma State Legislature to stifle the teaching of history from Black and Native perspectives.
We are at this crossroads of the fierce urgency of now because there's so many things happening from George Floyd to Terrence Crutcher to Breonna and all these other people that face negative energy from people who don't understand who they are or where they came from. And so now we're at this crossroads, but we have to ensure our children are educated. You got to know where you came from, know which way you're going. So we're at that point where we have to do something. We have to march together. Everything we need to do together. You know, they're in Oklahoma, they're shooting that film, The Killer of the Flower Moon. Most people don't even know about the history of those tribes, of tribal women and how they began to disappear and things like that. So there, we have this history in Oklahoma that's not, that hasn't been shared, that's now being shared along with the commemoration of the race massacre. There are many, many things now that are coming out that people need to understand. So the urgency of now, King said, we are now faced with the fact that tomorrow is today, and we are confronted with the fierce urgency of now. In this unfolding conundrum of life and history, there is such a thing as being too late. Are we too late?
Ms. Petty is hopeful that the Martin Luther King Jr. Parade, as well as the Commemoration Society's other community-wide events and activities, will help to open up these conversations. She stresses that it's important for students to learn about the patience, persistence, and perseverance that Dr. King taught in order for the next generation to have the tools necessary to solve today's challenges. For Focus Black Oklahoma, I'm Carlos Moreno in Tulsa.
Focus Black Oklahoma is proud to present a new series discussing topics of health and wellness in the BIPOC community. Contributor Robert L. Caddy is a certified health and fitness expert who brings us more on how Oklahoma ranks and the nation on health.
Welcome to the Health of the Nation, a series focusing on the proposed solution of mindfulness and media in shifting the current wellness challenge in our communities and the nation as a whole. The role of mindfulness and media in promoting better health. Oklahoma has ranked as one of the unhealthiest states in America, not only because of obesity, but because of the percentages of those listed with what is referred to as pre-existing conditions. Beyond the ever-popular fascination of our nation with overnight health remedies, the look of mental wellness, and now our honest fears of when the COVID-19 pandemic will end, we want to place a perspective before our listeners as to the reality of it all. The reality of the state of health and wellness in Oklahoma, the nation, and the world has reached a peak that is forcing us to question what has been widely accepted as remedy and solution. The constant repackaging of health options for citizens and states, the ever-widening gap between urban and rural communities, and the constant marketing and advertising of products that are keeping the spirit of capitalism alive, but that are hardly doing the mission of better health any justice. We bring mindfulness to the forefront of the conversation simply because a lack of it can be a driving force behind our stress, and stress can empower our urges and our emotions. We bring to the forefront media because it too plays a major part and what we accept as cause and as solutions as it pertains to the issues of wellness. When we use the term mindfulness, we're speaking beyond one breathing to gather themselves when offered the dessert they know will only support their diabetic diagnosis. When we say mindfulness, we're speaking beyond one calming his or herself in the midst of anxiety or stress because of not only the debilitating effect at a cellular level, but because healthy cells are the key to a strong immune system. Another factor that is important to maintaining a functioning immune system is food and diet. Diets vary per ethnicity and socioeconomic status. The health disparities that have created and sustained the gap related to the Black community has been connected to more than just addiction, but also to dietary options available within the Black community and communities of color. In most urban communities, you will find fast food restaurants with few fresh vegetable options, while lacking grocery stores that provide healthier choices. Scientist James Lee of Francis Crick Institute has listed urban America's fascination with fast food as a cause in the rising numbers of autoimmune diseases. When we say media, we're going beyond the imagery of a family coming together in the evening for dinner, though in fact society might benefit from more Claire Huxtables and Elise Keatons. But the reality of what is trending goes a step deeper than what our mothers were serving for dinner. Even Dr. Anthony Fauci, chief medical advisor to the White House, said that a lack of basic vitamins and minerals can cause people to be susceptible to COVID and other viruses. He also stated that the public should not lean specifically on supplements for immunity. It is without doubt that Dr. Fauci is pro-vaccine, and the current media coverage of COVID is definitely highlighting vaccination as the solution. When we speak on the role of media in promoting the solution to currently widening health disparities, we have to put in perspective that COVID is a virus. It is submicroscopic, and it is mutating and evolving. There will most likely be new versions of the vaccine needed because there will possibly be new versions of the variant. Mindfulness techniques and media outlets should be a source of factual information that can and will improve the lives of the citizens in our communities, states, and nation. This is the first segment in a series in which we will dig deeper and speak realistically about the use of alternative wellness concepts and ideas. For as many recognize, our culture, communities, and our nation's demographics are shaped by the effects of current health battles. My co-host Sharita Sweet and I will continuously implement the proposed usage of mindfulness in media as a solution to introduce culturally and ethically balanced perspectives regarding health and wellness. For Focus, Black Oklahoma, I'm Robert L. Caddy in Tulsa.
You're listening to Focus, Black Oklahoma. In our next piece, contributor Brittany Cordera takes us on a well-seasoned adventure towards decolonizing menus across the country.
Chef Andrew Black has been making magic with his cooking in Oklahoma City's Deep Deuce neighborhood for 15 years now. He was born in Jamaica, where he and his grandmother smoked meats in a clay oven they built together, and where slow cooking fresh and foraged foods was normal. This inspired him to be the chef he is today.
Growing up with my grandmother, you know, as an East Indian, our kitchen was outdoor. So we use the clay that we form and it get as hard as a brick. That's what we build our fireside from. So, you know, I grew up cooking with not gas or electric, but cooking over wood, so to speak. Roti, the puri, the dal, all those things just over open fire. I was always in the kitchen with her as the last kid. And so my curiosity about food has sparked since 9 years old. And I knew there and then growing up that I wanted to do something in the kitchen. This is what I love. It's my passion.
The community and history of the Deep Deuce neighborhood influenced him to open a triple restaurant in the area, which once consisted of La Baguette Deep Deuce, Black Walnut, and Gray Sweater. La Baguette Deep Deuce is moving to Yukon in 2022 to make more room for Black's mood restaurant and cocktail bar, Black Walnut. He spends a lot of time walking around the neighborhood, taking in the history.
I knew there was rich history over here, but I think once I opened this restaurant is where it really kicks in. And I receive a message from someone, I still don't know who it is, but they sent me a photo of what Deep Deuce used to look like over 60 years ago. And I just got goosebumps because of the history. This was where Martin Luther King wanted to preach his first sermon, right down the road from me. This was where some of the rhythm and guitars were found over in Deep Deuce. This was a music capital. This was where everything happened. Then I realized, wow, this is bigger than I am. I'm cooking in a location where people that look like me used to be here for years.
Out of all the places he has lived around the world, the history here is striking to him, and the community has made Oklahoma home for him. The Gray Sweater has a metaphorical ring to its name. It embraces comfortable and warm service, but the restaurant has no menu, and it does not abide by conventional ways of cooking. Just as the color gray suggests, the restaurant owes no allegiance to any one ingredient or flavor, allowing guests to go on taste-based adventures to places and stories undiscovered.
And I always knew I wanted to open a restaurant where cooking without boundaries and barriers is the front runner. And so when we decide what would represent it, it was gray. Because gray, is it black? Is it white? What is it? So what is Gray Sweater? We're not locked in a box. We're not traveling in any one road. It's a place where we're discovering ourselves, and our customer happened to be a part of the journey.
Black wants his guests to feel the stories of the ingredients on their taste buds.
I think in today's world, it's more than just eating. It's more than eating. To know you can sit and you're eating a pork from out of Canada, and it's been fed just milk. Milk-fed pork, it tells a story. It tells a story to be able to get beef from Shirashima, Japan, come all the way over to us and just putting it, you see the fat melting and that rich umami coming from it tells such a wonderful story. And it's a story that your taste bud receive that chances are you'll never forget it.
Most of the ingredients Chef Black uses are fresh and foraged from Oklahoma and elsewhere. In fact, Chef Black is the author of the cookbook Foraging in Oklahoma. Black believes that every meal he makes has a story to tell about the land and where the ingredients come from.
When I came to Oklahoma 15 years ago, people were forging, but not in a big way. And so I remember I was on a plane and someone said, there's nothing in Oklahoma. What are you down there? There's no farmers, nothing. And I'm like, you guys got to be crazy. There got to be stuff in Oklahoma. And so I set out to start forging with farmers here. And that's where I even published a book called Forging in Oklahoma. Now what we do for Gray Sweater, we wanted to tap into the world of forging. So we source ingredients from all around the world 7 days a week. You know, the whole idea is you're sitting and you're tasting something from a different country because food tells a story. And so we present that story and taste and experience with it. So we do, instead of just forging locally, we're forging from all over the world now.
Sean Sherman and Dana Thompson are the founders of Awamni, a modern indigenous full-service establishment. Their restaurant is located in Minneapolis, Minnesota, nestled in what is now called St. Anthony's Falls, a sacred site to the Dakota and Anishinaabe people.
Special location that it happens to be on, right on the Mississippi River downtown, right in front of the waterfalls that used to be there, that in the pristine form were called Awamni Yamni by the Dakota people that also lived there for countless generations. It was later renamed St. Anthony Falls, but we're really excited that we took the namespace back, which was just the short name of Awamni Yamni, which is just Awamni. And just paying homage to a lot of the Dakota history of that space, even putting all indigenous plants back in the park and putting signs around that showcase the Dakota names of those plants first.
Awamni has been open since July and has had many successes despite the pandemic causing short supply chains that have greatly impacted the restaurant industry.
We have had a lot of really interesting, it's amazing how many opportunities actually came out of the pandemic for us. It broke down the supply chain so quickly, and the food system was one of the first things to be affected by it. And so I think it really did an amazing job of raising awareness about the work that we're doing and really underscored the philosophy that we have.
The connection between Black and Sherman are their missions to decolonize the menu, the kitchen, and to allow their guests to explore the nature around them through food. Sherman and his team revitalize Native American cuisine, creating dishes that use ingredients central to the food systems of tribes from all over North America. And they source their ingredients from local and indigenous farmers and foragers. Awamni's menu features traditional indigenous flavors.
So it's just a really unique restaurant. It's just following the philosophy of what we've been working on for a long time, is showcasing indigenous foods of North America, cutting out European colonial ingredients. So there's no dairy, no wheat flour, no cane sugar, no beef, pork, or chicken. Really focused on a lot of wild food and flavors, prioritizing purchase from indigenous producers, and just really coming up with just some unique options that are really representative of true flavors of North America. And of course, all of our diverse indigenous communities. And featuring indigenous foods of different regions, you know, because we're showcasing what does indigenous foods of the Pacific Northwest taste like, or the Southwest, or the island of Manhattan, or wherever that might be, you know, and just utilizing our knowledge of the land space, the peoples that live there, and the agriculture that was there, if there was agriculture, and what kind of wild foods and wild game are in those regions, and all those pieces. So for us, we've just been working on it for so long. It's just how we develop food, and we try not even to fusionize foods, because we try to look at food as very place-based and seasonal. So we might have something here in Minnesota with wild rice, sunchokes, rose hips, blueberries, rabbit. And we can literally just stand in one spot in the forest and look around and see all those ingredients right around you.
Colonized food systems, particularly in the United States, contribute to the climate crisis by commodifying the land, stripping it of biodiversity, depleting fresh water sources, and producing food for profit instead of nourishment. Sherman is rematriating indigenous food systems, healing from his childhood, hiring an all-indigenous team, and connecting guests to sustainably harvested ingredients that are healthy.
The biggest part of the work that we do is just trying to showcase how valuable indigenous knowledge is on a pan-indigenous scale. So we not only look at North America, but we look at indigenous peoples all across the world. And we look at how indigenous peoples had these commonalities of living sustainably, utilizing primarily plant knowledge of all of this really extreme diverse regions. So we look at, you know, land-based indigenous educations where people had thousands of generations of knowledge being passed down, of being able to know what to do with the plants science around them, how to make food or medicine or craft out of everything, and how we could be utilizing so much more plant diversity and animal protein diversity too, when it comes down to it, and how much healthier that would be in our diet. And just looking at the mass production of the industrial movement of food and food production, and how damaging that is to not only our bodies personally and what kind of nutrition we get from that, but also just what it's doing to our land, what it's exposing us to with chemicals, how it's overutilizing water, and all the issues that comes with these massive monocultural GMO type farms. Part of it's just trying to right a wrong of what I grew up with, which was growing up on a very poor reservation, having to grow up on things like the commodity food program and the FDPIR, and understanding how poorly nutritional-less that whole program is, and all the health situations that come out of that, like type 2 diabetes and obesity and heart disease. So, but I think those are the biggest, most important pieces, is just not only understanding the diversities of indigenous knowledge bases and all these different regions, but understanding the commonalities of indigenous peoples and why the global knowledge base should really be hyper aware of that, try to steward and save and just protect indigenous nations and cultures and languages and knowledge bases on a global scale, because they've been rapidly disappearing over the past couple centuries, and they're still in danger today.
Their philosophy to help develop more indigenous food producers and influence indigenous peoples to eat healthier and be conscious of where their food comes from. From Focus Black Oklahoma, I'm Brittany Cordera in Deep Deuce.
Sometimes it takes a while for good advice to soak in, and by then, the credit seems to go to anyone but those closest to us. In our final segment, Sandra Slade tells us how she copes with one of her biggest pet peeves.
Have you ever given someone some advice or showed them something new and they disregarded it? Then the same person comes back to you later and explains the same thing as if it's a new concept? You might look at them, maybe even saying like, I've told you this before. You don't remember? Of course they don't. Just because they just learned this. This is a pet peeve of many people. This used to make my blood boil, and I would either walk off or just completely shut up. Through the years, I've learned that sometimes people will get things in due time and just sit back and watch. I can recall the countless Saturdays we got up listening to music while cleaning the living room where no one ever sat. Each week, it was the same dreaded chores. Dishes done, carpets vacuumed, clothes washed, folded, and put up. My job was to keep the bathroom clean. To make the job faster, I concocted this miracle solution. I put a bit of bleach, some dishwashing liquid, a sprinkle of Comet, and a piece of lemon in an old spray bottle. My mom asked me how I got the bathroom finished so quickly. I proudly showed her the concoction that I had made. She took the bottle and walked to the kitchen and showed me the cleaner she had labeled bathroom cleaner. Basically, the same stuff I had did. She reminded me that I told her I didn't need anything else. She walked off, shaking her head, muttering, "Oh, just wait till you have kids." I stood there, clueless. Me, I'm a list person. I have a list for everything. My husband at the time thought it was just a bit of my craziness, but tolerated it. I tried to, you know, encourage him to write stuff down, as he often forgot things. For years, he would laugh and say no. Then one day, we were packing for a vacation, and I noticed he had a list. I asked him about it, and he proudly told me his friend Jake had written down a list for some new places to go, and they were crossing them off. He then turned to me and said, "You know, these things are so handy." He didn't know why I hadn't mentioned them before. I stood there speechless and mad. The next list I wrote included the things I wouldn't be doing, like cooking, cleaning, and listening to his advice. My kids have a list of chores. They groan and mutter under their breaths. I just remind them, everybody's not like you, and one day you'll see when you have kids. Oh, yeah, I heard that just as I said it. After his first year in school, my son decided he and his friends were going to rent a house. He was so happy. New air fryer, spices, sheets, cooking stuff. And occasionally he would call me and tell me what he made to eat. Then his calls turned to about how his roommates would leave food on the stove, clothes in the washer for days. I kept my mouth shut. I wanted to go in. I told you so, but I didn't. I knew this day would come, like life was there to teach this lesson. One day, he thought he'd give me a nugget of wisdom. He called and asked me, "Hey, Mom, did you know that if you buy groceries and cook them at home, you could save money?" It took everything in me not to yell into the phone or just hang it up. For most people, getting out the door in the morning is hard enough. Add a slow-moving teenager in the mix and you will want to just crawl back in the bed. You know, I had bought everything for my daughter to make her lunch, and I would encourage her to make it before going to bed. But of course, she thought better. Many mornings were rough as she hurriedly threw food into a lunch pail. Until one of her friends suggested that they get matching bags and discuss what they were going to be putting in them. One hurried day, as she grabbed her already packed lunch, she told me how much easier it was since she and her friend packed them at night. I started to tell her to do the drop and roll as I dropped her off at school. My son and daughter were home over break, a glorious time for us. I was in the kitchen cooking some of their favorites that they had requested. Both kids were in the kitchen. Usually this is a no-no, as I'm making meatloaf. My son proceeds to tell me it would be best to crush the crackers in the sleeve, and my daughter is showing me how best to dice up the onions and green bell peppers. I stood there, slightly steaming, but quickly decided to give them a little taste of their own medicine. I said, "Really?" in my most quizzical voice. "Show me how." I laughed inside as they finished the meatloaf, took the potatoes, and showed me a new way to mash them with a manual masher. You see, they kept telling me how they had been watching Gordon Ramsay and how all the chefs were doing this or that. I just oohed and aahed over what they were showing me. I think I've just discovered the best tip for parents. Act like a clueless teenager, ask several questions, then sit back, relax, and watch your kids teach you all the lessons that you taught them. They get to show you how much they know, and you get to relax. Now that is winning.
Focus Black Oklahoma is produced in partnership with KOSU Radio, Tulsa Artist Fellowship, and Tri-City Collective. Additional support is provided by the George Kaiser Family Foundation and the Charles and Lynn Schusterman Family Philanthropies. Our theme music is by Moffitt Music. Focus Black Oklahoma's executive producers are Koresh Ali Lansna and Bracken Clark. Our associate producers are Nick Alexandrov and Vanessa Gaona. Our production intern is Smriti Iyengar. Visit us online at kosu.org, tricitycollective.com/focusblackoklahoma, and YouTube at Tri-City Collective. You can follow us on Instagram and Twitter at FocusBlackOK. You can hear Focus Black Oklahoma on demand for free at kosu.org, NPR1, npr.org, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Have you ever wanted to walk in the shoes of someone else, someone who thinks differently than you, to understand their perspective? KOSU invites you to take a concrete step towards healing the political divide through StoryCorps' One Small Step project. When you sign up, you'll get the chance to have a personal 50-minute conversation with someone new about your lives. So ditch the debate and learn the lived experience behind someone else's perspective. Sign up today at kosu.org/onesmallstep.